Hello, I'm Kevin Richard. Well, after 94 days, 94 chaotic days, the 2024 legislative session wrapped up on Wednesday. Ryan Supley and I had a chance to talk to State Superintendent Debbie Critchfield on Friday to recap the session, to talk about one item that was a high priority of hers that did become law, a couple of her priorities that did not become law, and sort of what her strategy is going forward on those issues. Word of warning, we did do this over Zoom. We did have a little bit of buffering issues early on in the interview, so bear with us, stick with us. The sound quality does get better, and we do cover quite a bit of ground, so I hope you enjoy the interview. Here is our conversation with State Superintendent Debbie Critchfield. Well, Superintendent Critchfield, thanks for joining us this week. We have a lot to get to as we try to recap this session. Give us just kind of the general overview of how you think this session went for education and for you personally.
I think positive. The few priorities that we had for public schools, finance, budgeting that we had heard last year, unfinished business, we were able to get that to the finish line. I think one of the biggest indications of the positive feel around legislation for education has been going into the regions. As we go around the state after the session concludes and get into each of the six regions, we gauge the comments, feedback, questions on where superintendents and business managers are. And by and large, it feels like a good year.
You've been hearing from them as you've been going out, even before the session actually adjourned. What are you hearing from them about the finance issue, about the supplemental money that's coming through?
Supplemental, that was a big priority, and people are feeling good. We had put forward in December that we thought that gap, based on data that we hold and keep, that it was around $160 million. Come February, we're adding new data and layering into that. It looked like it was closer to $145. And so to have 105 of that captured in discretionary, because our priority or our recommendation was that we get it all in discretionary and allow the maximum flexibility for districts. So to get the bulk of it into the discretionary or operational part of the budget, but then capture the additional $40 million in some different places, I think is huge. And most importantly in that was the fact that there was, as part of the intent language, if we do find that the gap is greater than 145, any additional monies will go into discretionary slash operational. So I think that that's a big win. A lot of folks on the education working group, as you know, in the finance committee, they work on different budgets. So public schools working group for the budget, we had a lot of communication with them, and we're really pleased with how that's turned out.
Yeah, Superintendent, we're talking here about the gap caused by moving back to the attendance-based formula, just to kind of fill people in. And that's last few years, it was based on, the funding formula was based on enrollment, which was more gainful for districts. I'm curious, was there any resistance in the legislature about delivering that funding?
Yes, I don't know that it came in real formal ways. I mean, they were conversations that I had, conversations that others involved in this effort had with a variety of people. I think that what I would say captures the disagreement or the hesitation, it really came down to the numbers. One of the things that we heard was, well, we knew there would be a difference, but we're not sure we can trust your data. Oh, okay, this is how we verify our data. This is what we've used in the past. I don't know why all of a sudden it's not good data now. And so we heard a lot about that, just how that translated into a dollar amount. So thankfully, we were able to work through that in a way that got people to believe in the numbers that we were putting out there. How do we capture that so that the districts could access it? I think one of the important talking points I had was that this money just doesn't become available. It's not just an automatic distribution to schools. You still have to have kids. And that was another thing that was said to me, and I think was sort of gated a lot. Well, we can't pay school if they don't have the kids. You know, it's on support units, and if our support units are reduced, and, you know, all of these things. And we never were portraying that the money should go to schools that don't have kids. And so as we really refined the messaging and talked about what the facts were, we want to make this available. As of right now, it wasn't even available. So that helped, I think, in the overall conversations.
And this is part of a larger conversation that's been happening for years about the funding formula. School leaders year after year say, we want an enrollment-based formula or something like it. Did you learn anything this session based on this conversation about the ADA supplemental? Did you learn anything about whether there is an appetite in the State House for moving in that direction?
You know, what it's an interesting lesson always in the legislature. Anything we hear constantly and recently that we all want to modernize funding, but when it comes down to what does that policy look like on paper, that's where people peel off or say, I didn't exactly think it was going to look like that. And the lesson from last year, or about this issue, was last summer when we put together the March. Committee folks statewide representing all sorts of interests, including legislators. We all agreed with the goal. We want to modernize funding. We want the funding to more clearly reflect the characteristics of the students that our schools have. Okay, that's the goal. How are we going to do that knowing that enrollment is off the table? And so we put together what we thought was the perfect hybrid of how to meet that goal, and unfortunately that stalled out in the House, and so our plan is we're going to bring it back. We believe in it. We believe that's the way to move forward, and we're still behind it.
What do you think the resistance to changing the formula is grounded in at this point? What's the big sticking point?
Oh boy, it kind of depends on who you ask that question. Some believe that by changing it, our district's going to be able to game a system, and so I think there's hesitation that there's maybe manipulations involved, which you don't agree with that narrative. For some, it's just different, and anytime you present something different, then you reproduce some feelings of being anxious and that uncertainty. Well, I think we were able to overcome that. We ran spreadsheet after spreadsheet to show that in the policy bill that we wanted to bring forward for discretionary, which, you know, $377 million of a $2.63 billion budget, that there was, if you want to call them winners and losers, there was about $200,000 worth of losing schools, I believe it was 8 charters or districts total, and we simply could not capture those because they don't have the kids. And so I felt like that even further supported the good composition of this policy bill.
I think you were just mentioning the sort of late session bill that would have taken discretionary money for schools and distributed that on a per student basis rather than through support units. That's the kind of complicated metric that basically represents a classroom. That seemed like you were taking a small portion of the overall budget and making an incremental change that might have paved the way for some broader changes later on. Is that how you viewed it?
100%. I couldn't have said it better myself. With the goal, on top of the others that have been stated, to make it more clear. We actually believe that this policy provided a more clear line as to the money that schools were getting for the types of students that they have. Some students cost more money. Whether someone likes that fact or not, the fact remains. Students that are involved in special ed programs need additional resources and have needs that are above some other students. We also recognize that for students who don't speak English. And we had identified 4 or 5 characteristics of students students in smaller rural schools take a few more resources. You think of economies of scale that they don't have in the smaller places. And we had put together a very thoughtful approach that included a lot of good math to say that we could honor the different parts of what it takes to put a classroom together that support units alone did not capture.
So what happened with that one? That bill ultimately didn't pass.
Well, we introduced a policy bill in House Ed, and the introduction was extremely precarious, and we didn't come back, and I guess I should say introduce the bill, but you know, for the technical lingo, we had the RS introduction, and then we heard after that introduction that as far as the viability of the bill going forward within that committee, based on some missing elements, many of the committee members had worked on the summer working group and recognized there were some things that were missing. And those missing pieces had been, I guess for a better lack of a better way of saying it, negotiated out. And they didn't want those out. And so the feedback to me was bring back the policy bill that we worked on with the stakeholders and that we all agreed to. And at that point, you lose some people. And I the only word I can come up with at this point is it's stalled out. And so we made a commitment that we're going to bring it back.
One of your big initiatives this year was to try to start an outcomes-based funding pilot, I guess is a good way to describe it. It passed the House. It died in the Senate Education Committee. What happened with that in your view?
That has been the big question for us this session relative to that bill. As both of you know, and many people know that follow these processes closely, typically a legislator will, if they're going to vote against something, will indicate, hey, I like everything but this, or I just can't get on board with this idea, or whatever. That was the mystery of Senate Ed on that particular day. It was just flat out votes. Now, do those legislators have to explain their vote? No, they don't. But it's useful and helpful to know what pieces or parts weren't well received. And, you know, we heard some chatter after that, you know, folks didn't think that new money should be given to schools to reach the outcomes. We're tired of putting more money into schools when they're not getting their outcomes. Well, my answer back to that was, this was budget neutral. We had figured out how to use existing dollars to do it. And so I've scratched my head a lot on that one. To be honest, earlier that day, connecting my own dots, which may or may not be the right connections. Earlier that day was the vote on the tax credit. And some of the individuals in the House Ed Committee had been supportive of what was trying to happen over on the House side. And so was that retribution to public schools? Again, without having had specific conversations with people, I'm left to speculate like others, but to put forward a policy bill that reflected a conservative approach and answered many of the statements and interests that I've heard from the legislature, not just last year or this year, but for years, that we need to more closely tie our funding to outcomes, I was left wondering. We're going to bring it back because we believe in it.
Yeah, you've kind of answered the follow-up question that I had. I mean, the idea of tying funding to outcomes, to performance, is a pretty conservative concept. Senate Education may be about as conservative a committee as we've had at the State House. So it sounds like that is a puzzle to you too, what happened in that particular committee on that particular day.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if it's, again, just the afternoon feelings of what didn't happen in the morning on the House side.
Right.
Is it personal to me that somehow that would reflect a win for me, that somebody doesn't want me to have a win? I, to be honest, I, we've, my team and I and others, it was one of these, it was enough of a head scratcher that we had education folks around the state say, what happened? That this was about as conservative as you can get. It's all the, it's all the things that that have been discussed that some folks believed were lacking in school funding. Yeah, and I just said, I don't know. Your guesses are as good as mine. We didn't hear from the committee, and we'll bring it back. We believe in it.
Well, you mentioned you're bringing it back. Can you just, I mean, expand a bit on why you feel this is important? I mean, the specific bill this year would have tied $40 million to achievement in math and career readiness and college readiness. Why does that matter so much to you?
Funding is important to schools to drive the priorities. And it is very challenging, if not extremely difficult, to get a brand new lump sum of money to jumpstart goals that we have, and we are lagging in math. And we want those outcomes in the secondary with graduation rates and, you know, CTE stuff. And so for me, this was that blend of, if we want our districts to prioritize this work in these subject areas, they're going to say to me, we are already line itemed out. There isn't extra money to put into some of these things. Okay, well, if I go and just flat out hold my hand out to the legislature and say, hey, we need about $40 million to go this, that, or the other, that's not well received. And so we still have the needs and we still have the goals around these areas. And to bring it back in a way that says, we're going to incentivize districts, it wasn't a gimme. We're going to incentivize districts to get the outcomes, and then we're going to ask them to put this money into those things that sustain the outcomes. To me, it checks all the boxes. I had a lot of national folks reach out to me from other states watching. We can't wait to see how you're doing this. We've been trying to do this in our state. We've been hearing this from our Republican legislatures. And again, to come back with, okay, well, that was interesting. We said, yeah, it was, but we still have the goals, and we're trying to satisfy or find that balance and sweet spot of how you put more money in, but also have the expectations and that accountability tied to it. And this did all of those things.
So maybe the biggest education bill of the year, maybe the biggest bill of the year period, was House Bill 521, the school facilities law, that had a lot more to it than just the school facilities funding, although that's historic and that's what I wanted to ask you about. How do you see that unfolding now that it's become law? What are you looking to see happen with that $1.5 billion over 10 years? How does it unfold? What's your role, and how do you measure success?
These are all the things that have been on our list for the last couple of weeks, anticipating a successful passage. And, you know, clearly it was a governor's initiative. Even in a state of the state, we knew he would sign it. So once we got it through the legislature, we sat down to understand what our role would be. We will be partnering with the state building authority. They will be the ones that will be issuing the bonds. And as I mentioned, going into the regions on our post-legislative tour, we've spent a chunk of time talking about this. There are three things that I want districts to know and that I anticipated would be their questions. One, when are we gonna get the money? Two, what do we have to do to get the money? And then the third thing that I added to this was setting expectations in communities and frankly, within a building or a district with staff themselves. As we know, the law becomes in effect July 1. The legislation says that the first distribution should be made by August 31st. Not unlike any district who has successfully passed a school bond, there is a waiting period. The bonds have to be issued. So for districts to know that they will not get, even if they have everything that ready on their end, it is not possible for them to get all of their money. It is not possible for the state of Idaho to distribute $1.25 billion by August 31st. And I don't know that we've talked about that as the expectation, but it's been so widely touted that I was fearful that some of our districts would say, hey, we're going to have all that money. And so we've been talking about those two things. Well, those three things.
And have you heard back from local school leaders about what they're going to do with the money, with their share of
that? Yes. Yeah, so we've done, in the three regions of the six that we've been to, we've kind of done this straw man poll where I asked a question and say, how many of you will be ready to, you know, if you could get all of your money, how many of you will be ready to have it? And most of the room raises their hand. Then I ask the question, who's expecting or anticipating that they'll take it as a lump sum rather than annualized? And everyone raises their hand for that. So in working with our partners at the Building Authority, we have from them communicated to the districts that by August 31st, a portion, and we believe at least 10% of the money will be able to be distributed to them by the 31st, and that as the bonds are sold, and that's something that those folks, that's what they do, that is their job, as they chunk those bonds out to make them the most competitive, to get the best interest rates, that it will be rolling distributions, even with the lump sum.
We heard during this whole debate over 521 a lot of outpouring from the four-day schools, a lot of support for continuing four-day schools and concern that this law was going to get in the way of that. Do you feel like that was taken care of? Do you feel like the 4 days are in a good position, or in addition to schools that may be looking at going to a four-day calendar?
I definitely think it diffused the controversy and the issue over it, to the point that I had been told or alerted that at the State Board of Education meeting in Moscow next week that there were upwards of 40 superintendents that were going to drive to the board meeting to speak to the board on, you know, why this worked or that thing didn't work. With the passage of the trailer and allowing districts to meet state-required hours that are already in code, I was told this morning that there aren't any superintendents that are going to make the journey.
So you want to have a caravan to Moscow.
Exactly. And so I know that although it has let the air out of the balloon for right now, it still is a very hot conversation. The board is still in a position to set the minimum number of student instructional days. And we will do that, not at the April meeting. It will take place at the regularly scheduled June meeting. And there will be a discussion on what the days look like. The average four-day district in Idaho goes 146 days. The average five-day district goes 172 days. And then when you start looking at the hours, the difference between the average four-day and the average five-day on hours is only about 19 hours. And so there's a lot of moving parts in this. And I think it's going to be a great discussion for the board. And what I'd also like to bring into this conversation, despite the hours or days, or I guess in addition to hours or days, we've got to have a conversation about absenteeism. Doesn't matter how many hours or days are required. We hear everywhere in the state how it is very challenging to get more consistency about kids coming to school.
That's interesting. We don't talk as much about that. Is that a post-pandemic thing? Or what's driving that?
100%. And I'll tell you something that's also very interesting about this, just different data points. It's not defined or confined to one type of student or one type of demographic. So I think we look at in the past and we would say, well, some students struggle coming to school because maybe their socioeconomic environment or their family situation keeps them from coming. Affluent families have the same attitudes of they want more flexibility. They want to have their child be able to complete an assignment online or have it delayed, or could we just watch that virtually? We're going to take vacations. So you see that end of the spectrum, and then you see the other spectrum of perhaps it's just more challenging to get some kids to schools and to school, and parents just say, eh, somehow we worked it out. I'm hearing increasingly from schools who have tried to crack down on their attendance policies, which all districts have, that the harder that they have pressed on parents and enforced their policies, the more many parents have just said, well, we're just going to go to online schools then. So schools have said to me, I mean, I'm very generalizing schools, but I talk to superintendents all over, big, small, rural, urban, north, south, wherever you are. They're consistent themes. And they're saying, help us know what to do. We have policies, but if we enforce them, we seem to drive the negative behavior that we're not, you know, that we're trying to move away from.
You're always pushing kids out of the schools when you're trying to get them into the schools.
Absolutely. You know, how do we get there? And so I want to put together some, and I'm not going to call it a task force because that's too big of a word, but an open discussion around the state where we put it out on the table. Fundamentally, education, if we're providing a relevant experience that provides what we want our students to be able to know and do, that in itself becomes a driver. Now, with that said, we don't control what families are doing, and I'm not suggesting that we do, but so long as our funding is tied to attending students, this has to be on the table as a discussion point.
I want to shift gears, though, to another issue that involves you as a member of the state board. Legislature came up pretty strongly pushing back against the University of Phoenix purchase and really pushing back against the state board for approving this. I guess I wanted to get your response as a board member and where this leaves this proposal.
I think we're in a holding pattern. The deal isn't off the table. I think the legislation that many viewed, including myself as the salve to some of the concerns and the anger over it, we know that died. And so we're at this juncture of there's a deadline that either party can walk away
May 31st.
Without any type of penalty. We're getting closer to that. There are many in the legislature who are not satisfied, and it hasn't mattered how much information, answers, data, you know, we've put a lot of things out there. I know President Green, working with his staff, has gone above and beyond to provide information. At some point, for some people, it doesn't matter what the answer is. They don't like it. And so I don't know how we thread the needle. And our board has not met as a full board to discuss what that looks like and what the options are.
Does that come up? Does that come up at next week's board meeting? Or this week's
board meeting? I don't believe that. I'm trying to remember the agenda. The final agenda will be posted today. And so I will go take a look. As you know, there are many different committees. And so I don't know what every single committee has ready to go on their agenda. And so I'm going to take a look today to see, where that fits. They're still on the board side. We still stand behind the decision that we made and believe that this is an opportunity. You know, a comparison I've made recently, or a dot I've connected in my mind, has to do with ICOM, the for-profit medical school. I was a new board member back when this came as an idea to then Governor Butch Otter. And there were a lot of people who said, bad idea, it won't work, it's going to end up costing the state a lot of money. You know, and now we are down the road and we see what a benefit and a value it's been for our state. Now, it might not be exactly apples to apples, but, you know, using something like that in my mind got me over some of the issues of the concerns that I had. And so we'll wait to see what the next moves are.
In the couple of minutes we have left with you today, is there anything that you're looking at in this off season, coming out of this session, that we haven't talked about yet that's going to be taking up a lot of your time, a lot of your energy, a lot of your focus in the weeks and months ahead?
We're going to really dive into the gaps that we have in the state with special ed. You know, one of the things that you've heard, as well as I have, folks have said, well, if the federal government isn't pulling their weight and isn't paying for the things that they're requiring us to do, just don't take the money and then you don't have to meet the requirements. Well, we still have to meet the requirements. This is a big issue, and that kind of, it takes me a little full circle back to why we were doing the per student weights as a way to offset some of that. So we will be talking about that. We increasingly see districts who need more support, more resources, and more help in dealing with students who have needs. You folks have reported on things. We have had more interaction at our office this last year than apparently has taken place in the last 5 years when it comes to disputes and how, you know, dispute resolution. So we have a big effort around that. We're going to also put some things forward around teacher ethics. Teachers have a professional ethical code that they must adhere to when they get their certificate. And our professional standards committee meets on their quarterly or regular basis. And for some teachers, we want to help them stay out of their own way. And so you're going to see some things come forward to help our professionals.
Well, Superintendent Kirchfield, thank you for joining us this week. We covered a lot of ground here post-session. We'll sure we'll be talking again real soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Again, that was State Superintendent Debbie Kirchfield. If you need to catch up on anything that happened in the 2024 legislative session, those 94 days of legislative session I talked about in the intro, please go to idoednews.org. Ryan Supi and I have a complete rundown of what happened and what didn't happen in education. I take a closer look at the Mike Moyle session. I explain in my Thursday analysis piece how Speaker Mike Moyle was the defining force in this legislative session. The most comprehensive legislation, some of the most controversial legislation. He was right in the middle of it. I explain kind of how that broke down and what the implications are for schools and what the future may hold. Elsewhere in Idaho, Carly Flandreau has a closer look at Pocatello, where trustees are actually urging voters to say no to a bond issue coming up in May. She has the explanation on that. Darren Savant has the latest on CUNA, where school officials are dealing with ongoing growth issues and are hoping to get some help in dealing with growth in overcrowded schools. He has the story there. And continue to watch us at idoednews.org for the latest news on education policy and education politics. Ryan Supi and I shift our attention now to elections. The May 21st primaries are not that far away. In fact, early voting is underway. Early ballots are going out, I should say. We will take a closer look at several races around the state that have really, really important education implications. We'll have full stories on that. We've also sent out questionnaires to candidates from all over the state, and we'll be running out those responses in the weeks to come. So as you're getting ready for the May 21st primary, please do come to us for the latest on education-related news pertaining to those primaries. Follow us also on X at idoednews.org. We will tweet out our bulletins to our bulletins on any breaking news, links to our latest stories. I'm sorry, I still cannot call this thing the X, and I still call them tweets. Facebook hasn't changed, and you can follow us on Facebook there and comment on our stories. And check us out at idoednews.org. We have the latest every day on education policy and education politics. Until our next podcast, I'm Kevin Richard. Take care.